Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of VGC, the video game podcast, where we will be reviewing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. Before you click away, there will be no spoilers, so don't worry about that. I have assembled an excellent party of heroes to go through the game, the good, the bad, and the ugly. We have Alex Donaldson from VG247 and RPG Site. We have Ed Nightingale from Eurogamer, and we have Jade King from The Gamer. Now, before we get started, I think it's good to set a baseline, because some of us in this chat are Johnny RPG and some of us maybe aren't as au fait with the game. So let's go around the table. Tell me your history with Final Fantasy VII specifically, and then a broad, and this is, I'm telling you this, Alex, before you go on a 5-minute rant, a broad overview of how you feel about the game. Alex, you start.
I guess I'm the mega nerd. So my background more broadly is I got into video games media through the Final Fantasy fandom, in the sense that when I was like 11, a friend and I founded a Final Fantasy fan site that was about Final Fantasy 9 specifically. We were fans coming off 8, actually, not 7. Founded a fan site for 9 in advance of its release and translated stuff coming over from Japan and stuff. And the long story short is that one thing leads to another. And, you know, ultimately, by the time I was actually an adult, that stuff was paying the bills. And then I started to write about games full time. And the descendant of that site is RPG site, RPGsite.net, which is my main thing that I do most of the time. And so my relationship with 7 is 8 was my first one. And I played 8 and then I played 7 and then I got 9 at launch. 9 was my favorite. And remains my favorite. That's an extremely special game to me. If/when they remake that, they'd better do it well. Seven is a really deeply important game to me, despite the fact that 8 was my first. I've got behind me, there's 2 signed Final Fantasy games up there. One is 9, signed by Nomura and Sakaguchi, and one is 7, signed by, not Nomura and Sakaguchi, Uematsu and Sakaguchi. And one is 7, signed by Sakaguchi, Uematsu, and Kitase. So they're the 2 that actually make it onto the shelf. So 7 means a lot to me. How did I feel about this? in a short sentence. God, I mean, the broad strokes is, I think this is about the same level of quality as Remake was. I think it's about the same level, I would say. But I think Remake really... I looked it up and Remake was like 87, 88 Metacritic, and I think it's a better game than that. I think it's a vastly better game than that, actually, despite some flaws. And I feel like this addresses a lot of the issues with Remake, but what they do is a big old kitchen sink approach, and what that does is introduce a whole new suite of problems. and so there's some things in the game that I take a pretty significant issue with, but I think it's excellent. I think 90% of it is excellent, but the 10% that's rough is pretty frustrating. Mm. I think for the record, though, with apologies to lovely friends who worked on and are in that game, I think it craps all over 16. I don't even think it's close. But I am the person who felt that 16 was like aggressive sort of 7 out of 10-ish and sort of I felt it was a little bit overrated. And I think public opinion is turning on that pretty quick, which it always does on Final Fantasy games, to be fair. I really, really enjoyed it. It's really good. It's really long, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit here.
Yes.
And there is like a laundry list of problems, some of them small, some of them significant, most of them small. But the stuff it does well is so, you know, this game got me emotionally a few times. And the combat still absolutely slaps. That's the big thing, is that this is the best action-based version of ATB they've ever expressed, and it continues to be. And I actually think this is so much more engaging over the course of a 50, 60, 70, 100-hour game than sort of a Devil May Cry facsimile, which we got last time.
I agree. The combat is so good. It made me want to do extremely boring things, but we will get there. Jade, your history with FF7 and your elevator thoughts about Rebirth?
Yeah, I think I was like one of those millions of people who played Final Fantasy VII as a kid, and it wasn't my first in the series. And it was like that influential piece of media back then that kind of informed how I feel about the genre and the series for years to come. So quite like a personal relationship with that game. And I think that makes you view Remake and Rebirth in a new light. Mm-hmm. And like, as a result, I've been into JRPGs all my life. And it's one of the big reasons I got into this line of work. But I suppose with Rebirth, agreeing with Alex, I think it's broadly excellent in a lot of ways. But I also think it does try to do too much, and it introduces a few too many like mini games and other bits of nonsense, which is weird because in a way a lot of it is surprisingly restrained and curated in its like storytelling and characters, but then it will go over the board so many times. But yeah,
then you're playing football as a dog against a giant chicken, then 5 minutes later you're in tears. Like, that's basically
exactly. It's like that all the time.
Well, how many times in this game did the developers clearly go, you know what, we've got the assets and we're in Unreal and it's quite easy to make,
just smash that
Fall
out.
Guys from Wish.com, Rocket League from Wish.com, and they go, you know what, let's just make it and put it in.
Yeah,
that's what it feels like. But also, Alex said, like, I do think this is a league above 16, mainly because of what it does with the open world stuff, and it's significantly less dour and like full of itself and trying to be Game of Thrones. Like, this is trying to be Final Fantasy VII, and it's trying to be ridiculous, and it's trying to be heartfelt, and I think broadly it manages that. I haven't finished it yet though, like, and you guys have, so we'll see how I feel in about 5 hours' time.
Finished it with not a moment to spare last night, eyes falling out my head.
I think everyone did. Okay.
Yeah, pretty much. That's when Alex messaged me saying he'd finished it, I had great hopes that I was nearly there. I certainly was not. Ed, your relationship with Final Fantasy VII and your overall thoughts on Rebirth?
So there's that sort of thing saying of the first one you play is your favorite, and that is very much me. Seven was my first one. I actually played it on PC a couple years after it came out. I have the copy behind me on here, and it's not my
copy.
Sorry,
have you got the crazy box, the Trapezoid?
No.
Oh, the IDOS one. That one goes for a bit now.
It is just the discs.
He's got the game, that's all that matters.
And this technically isn't mine. Because I, at school, didn't have a PlayStation. Everyone was talking about Final Fantasy. I was like, I want to play these games. I don't have a PlayStation. And this guy at school was like, hey, I've got it on PC. Do you want to borrow it? I was like, great, would love to. And then I kind of permanently borrowed it. And he, I think he was called Andy. And he never... He basically left the school and never came back.
Andy Robinson? Is that why he hates Final Fantasy now?
Far, far too long.
And I never got a chance to give it back, but I kept it and I love it. So 7 is my favorite. It was my sort of gateway in. 8 is a very close second because it's the one I played next. So I'm a big fan of the series. I loved 16.
I like 16. I just felt
the highest of highs and the lowest of lows, that game, I think.
I get that, and I think in some ways it is kind of the opposite of Rebirth. I think Rebirth, for me at the moment, I'm a bit torn, and I think maybe it's because it's fresh in my mind from finishing it last night. I think it has really made me wrestle with my own protectiveness of the original and how much I really enjoy the original, and seeing that in a different way. On the one hand, I'm like, oh, that's different, that's cool, and then I'm like, oh, that's different, why have you done that? And I've sort of really wrestled with that over 60 odd hours of playing this, and I think I'm still wrestling with it now, trying to comprehend exactly where I'm gonna land.
There's a bit of what I've called Star Wars syndrome, but we'll talk about that.
For me personally, I was someone who saw Cloud before I knew what Final Fantasy VII was. I saw a figure of him in Forbidden Planet and thought, that sword looks fucking amazing. I want to know what that game is. But then when I realized that it was a JRPG, like a turn-based thing, I was never into turn-based RPGs with the exception of Pokemon when I was younger. Like, I was always about action games. So by the time I actually came to play Final Fantasy VII, I felt like I'd seen every bit of it through references and other things and through countdowns of the top 10 saddest moments and all that stuff. So I don't really have much like protection over it or much personal expectations. Like, the most invested I've ever been with it was with Remake, which I got the platinum in. Like, I played that game to absolute death. So I really enjoyed Rebirth. Obviously there's large portions of this game that we cannot speak about, and they influence our opinions of it greatly. It's just to say that we spoke about this a bit off air. It just about manages to deliver a full story as a game, if you can like hand wave away a few things. But I was playing it with someone watching me, and it was so quickly like, we need to get the wiki up. Like, what does this mean in relation to this? And I do wonder if by the time the third game is out, will we look back at this as like a middle chapter that does make sense? But it's hard to know. As a video game, like a capital V, capital G video game, loved it. I think the combat's brilliant. It's full of like open world fluff from like the early 2010s, but when the combat is good and the things you're actually doing in that fluff, it works enough for me. I did all that stuff. I think the characters are rock solid. Like, these characters are unbelievably good, to the point where I was doing anything just to get more wee dialogue bits out of them. I have a soft spot for the minigames. They're super daft, but I did all of them to like the highest rank, just because I was like,
there's a lot I haven't done yet. Like, I haven't gone back to the Golden Saucer. I've been too busy trying to finish the bloody game.
Yeah, like all that stuff. Like, every time there was a piano, I sat down and did that to the highest rank. Like, I loved so much of this game's like individual pieces and kind of the episodic nature of the stories in between. But I feel like from minute one to minute 70 hours later, if you were to write down like what actually happened to these characters, it's kind of not a lot. Like, it doesn't feel like it actually pushes things forward at all. Go ahead, Alex.
So this is actually one of my biggest criticisms of the game, narratively. Maybe this is because, you know, my degree was in this crap, so I'm interested in storytelling techniques and stuff like that. But the interesting thing about Remake is Remake takes what is basically Act 1 of a three-act story and perfectly carves that, actually, into a three-act story of its own. So you sort of have your Act 1 is everything up until the Marco Reactor 5 stuff, and then Cloud falls, and then Act 2 comprises everything from meeting Aerith up to the plate falling, and then everything else after that is Act 3. And you even have there your dark middle chapter, the plate falls, it's horrible, you know, people have died, you've lost people, Aerith's been abducted, da-da-da-da-da. And so they carve this game into this perfect, and you feel a sense of resolution at the end. Now, I'm not saying that every story has to be a three-act story, because it doesn't, and that's a folly anyway. But what I would say is, if you tried to plot out what the actual act structure or story structure of this game is, I don't think I could do it. It doesn't actually have one. There isn't such a thing really in this game as an inciting incident or a turning point, because all that stuff happened in the first game. And so, yeah, you can argue, well, it's a sequel, it's the middle act of a trilogy. But if you think about Empire Strikes Back or Two Towers or any of these things, or even like Matrix Reloaded, a less accomplished one, you still have those beats in the story. That's what makes the story tie. And that's a big issue for me, where because of the section of the game they've made, they've sort of made some but not all of Act 2 of the original game. I would say Act 2 of the original game, a lot of people would say it ends at the Forgotten Capital, but I would say it arguably ends in the crater when Cloud hands over the Black Materia. And so that's one of the elements of the story where the characters are really good and the writing's really good. So those things sort of carry it, because Barrett is so good and Yuffie's so good, and the way some of these characters interact and the way they keep separating the party in order to let specific characters have moments alone is all so tremendously brilliant that it sort of carries it. But the moment to moment, A to B to C of the story is actually kind of bad.
Yeah.
As a result, and it's not like, it's not for want of trying, but I think it's just a natural conclusion of the bit of the game that this, the bit of the original narrative that this makes up.
Yeah.
I think for me, the structure of it is essentially just one long crescendo to one big point that we all know is going to happen, and, or does it? And that, I think, is kind of the way they've told the story is just stalling. Because
you
we can't write that for
100 hours.
Yeah, but they try to. And so I feel like it meanders a lot and it pulls you in all these different directions to like distract you and say, oh, well, maybe we won't do what we think we're going to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's just that story structure thing. Someone said to me, what act are you in? And I was like,
no, because you're right. Like, it's like as soon as you get out of Nibelheim, it's all that open world stuff from the original leading up to, you know, and there's big moments within that, but you can't really segment them as acts as much as you can just like character stories. Like Cosmo Canyon is like, and like Coral, those are all like big moments, but
yeah, they drive characters, right? But like the only, like, I can literally only pinpoint one cutscene where I feel like it's almost like a stakes changer cutscene to some degree, which is just the, and I think it's the best cutscene in the game by a million miles, just in terms of the way it's directed, the ambience, the music, the way it builds up to the boss fight. And that is literally the last cutscene before the boss on the boat. And it's sort of this great stakes setter of here's an enemy that, to be honest, probably shouldn't have been in part one because that would have been even more effective, but they did crowbar it into part one. Because in the first, in the original game, obviously that's where you meet that enemy. But that's the only cutscene I can think of in the whole. And it's like, yeah, because like the Barrett and Dine stuff is amazing.
That was really
actually
well
made
done
me
in
tear
this.
Up. And John Bentley, same. John Eric Bentley, John Bentley, his performance is incredible. But yeah.
I also think conversely, some of the stuff in the original that maybe didn't land as much lands more here. Like when Kate Sif betrays you in the Golden Saucer with like the key card or whatever. That kind of shook me by surprise in the original because they weren't in your party for very long. But in this, they kind of shift around the sequence. So when that happens and that betrayal happens, you're almost like, oh, I'm genuinely hurt now. And it takes all your equipment away. And I think that was a really cool way of making that feel permanent, unless they change it towards the end, which I haven't gotten to yet. So
I think all the... Yeah, that's the... I can't think of many beats that aren't actually better in this in a way, but it's almost the way those beats coalesce. Actually, there is one that is, I think, worse, which is, and this gets into Star Wars syndrome, there's a bunch of new stuff in Cosmo Canyon. So you sort of have the stuff with Red's dad from the original game, which for people who haven't played the original game, that's a tremendously classic scene. I think it's done with wonderful aplomb. And again, John Eric Bentley has one little line read at the very end of that. And it's just, it's him selling another character's moment and it's beautiful. But then there's sort of a turn and it's like almost because they didn't want to mess with those events, they wait for those events to get out of the way. And then they go, right, here's all the bullshit now.
No, that's
here's
exactly
all the backstory.
What I thought.
His backstory to a key item from the original game that didn't have a backstory. And I'm like, but did it not have a backstory because it didn't need a backstory?
And it's in this cave down here, which is really convenient. And that was just like...
And that's the first bit of Star Wars syndrome for me. It's that need to explain a lot of stuff that...
It needs to fill in the gaps.
Game is just sort of, but it's to pad the time,
good,
right?
Because...
The other Star Wars syndrome thing, by the way, is... I have a whole thesis in an article I've written about Star Wars syndrome as it relates to this game. Katase is a huge Star Wars fan, especially. It's everyone from Midgar that you sort of met in the first game that was remotely important, upping sticks and leaving Midgar so you can meet them all again, which just makes the world feel tremendously small. Like, did all the gym bros from War Market need to...
That felt the most unnecessary. Johnny in Costa del Sol, I understood. And
well,
that
he goes
like,
there
cool
originally in the
there.
First game, though,
yeah,
right? Like,
that
that's
makes
his
sense,
whole story.
Shifting everyone else out, it's like... It would have been more interesting for them to introduce new characters because they do introduce some from like other games, which is interesting.
Yes.
But I'd rather they rely on more cool original characters adding to this universe and leaning on it because they think we're scared of not having familiarity. That feels like a weak point to me.
What did you guys think of the character side quest stuff in terms of how the side quests are tied to one individual character each? Did you like that? Did you not like that? Did you miss the party element?
I think prior to launch, I was worried it was going to be very like BioWare or The Witcher light, especially in regards to like the character affinity stuff you get. It's like, oh, your relationship has changed and this is going to lead to the date and so on. I thought that could be quite unnecessary. But a lot of those quests where you're split off with individual characters, there's some great dialogue there, even if some of the like narrative arcs you follow along them are quite predictable. Mm-hmm. It helps those characters shine in a way they haven't before and arguably didn't in the original. And it adds depth while being true to them. It feels like rarely in games like this will I bother going to do all the side quests and stuff. But I think attaching them to the characters and giving them that context made them more valuable. I certainly didn't expect it, which was welcome, because they had similar quests like this in 16. Mm-hmm. But it felt like you were just, I don't know, going to kill something and then just having a cutscene, and then you go on to do the next thing.
I completely agree. Like, I really enjoy the extra characterization. I think there were some really lovely moments in there, some really lovely script pieces in there that just add to the characterization. And I like that they are more explicit, because, again, if you've played the original, you know there's a date scene coming, and it's always been a little bit kind of in the background of what's really going on there. And I sort of appreciate that they've just made that more explicit and more upfront of this is how you're going to get the date you want, which maybe gamifies it a bit. But I think it's that idea again of, well, they're playing with expectations of, we know you know what's going to happen, so we're going to give you a way to gamify it if you want. But more than anything, like I said, it was just characterization, and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, my only element of it that I was, as a mechanic that I slightly question is, because they tie it to the date stuff and people know about the date stuff, do you end up in a weird situation where you sort of discourage people from completing some quite good side quests? Because they're like, well, I don't want to do the Aerith quests because I don't want affection points for Aerith. I want a date, Tifa, or whatever. So that element of it, I'm a little bit like, ooh, and maybe we're talking about this before, if the menus were a little bit clearer in the sense that there is a menu which absolutely tells you more outright where you stand with everyone, but they don't surface that until you finish the game.
Yeah, because what happens if you max out all the quests anyway and you get to that date sequence? Can you pick? Like, is it clear or is it a roll of the dice?
I think there are... We don't know how it works, right? But my theory is there are certain events that are baked into the main story that sort of act as a tiebreaker.
Yes, okay.
So, yeah, and I think if it's anything like the original game, it's basically, it's going to be Aerith or Tifa, but then if you want one of the other ones, you've really got to work at it. Like, you need a guide and you have to follow very strict dialogue options if you want Barret or Yuffie in the original game. So I imagine that's going to be the same here. I'm sure people, this will be the interesting thing. Once Reddit gets his hands on that and people mess about with save games and go back and forth, it'll really...
I think synergy is also part of it, because if use a synergy with characters, it gives you a boost. So it's also about who you've had in your party the most, which is probably why I got that 13.
The impression I got was that it was only the first time you used a synergy move.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, but
I guess, you could avoid which one you unlock.
You could avoid using synergy with Aerith, but I feel like you're likely to probably use each synergy move at least, if nothing else, to see the animation, because the animation is cool.
That's what I did.
How did you like that mechanic?
I forgot synergy it existed a lot of the time. Well, the main synergy skills, which are essentially limit breaks in a way, like you build up those gauges and you deal loads of damage. But when you can press the shoulder button and there's a few on the face buttons you can use, I kept forgetting those were a thing. Like, I kept having to remind myself. And they didn't have as big an impact on combat as I thought they would, or I was just struggling way more than I needed to for no reason. But yeah, I thought it was cool. One thing I loved most about it is in Remake, it felt like if you kept Cloud buffed up enough, you could just rely on him. Mm-hmm. But I feel like synergy, especially with the way that each character needs to have their gauges built up to execute these attacks, it encourages you to switch between them all the time, which I really appreciated, especially having new party members that you wanted to experiment with. It was a cool incentive.
The strange decision, and I'd love to know if you have any insight on this, Donaldson, why we're doing Ubisoft Towers and 2024's Final Fantasy VII Rebirth.
I mean, I don't think there's any major insight other than to say that I think Square has an approach where they look at what other people are doing a lot, but I think these games take so long to make that inevitably by the time you've delivered it, the world has moved on a little bit. I think it's okay, though, but I did sort of, when I was writing my review, I wrote it out. I was like, I want to write this out and see how it feels. And I think this is interesting context for people listening to the podcast who don't have the game yet. So the game basically has six open world zones. All of those zones have one town. One of the zones has two. And basically within each of those zones, there is the following. There's between four and six towers that you climb and activate. This reveals activities on the map, but if you find the activities, stumble across them on your own, you can still do them. You don't have to light up the towers. There's between four and six combat assignments. So they're just like a set combat scenario. I think these are really fun. They've all got optional objectives that you can beat them in a specific way. So they might ask you to poison an enemy, or usually it's just to stagger and pressure, though, which I feel like they could have done a bit more with that, but I still really enjoy that. This is where it starts to get a bit now for me. There's three summon crystals.
Oh, those suck. I don't like
completing those. completing those makes you summon either easier to unlock or more powerful. There's three per zone. There's one summon allocated to each zone. And they're all Simon Says puzzles, so it shows you a bunch of face buttons to press, circle X, whatever, in a certain timing, and you have to repeat it back. That's obviously, the puzzles are just slightly different every time, the buttons you're pressing, but the thing you do is the same every time. There's four life springs in each zone. So these are like deposits of live stream energy that you have to scan. This scanning minigame, for some reason, is exactly the same QTE every single time. Don't quite know what that was about, what they were thinking there. You could have at least made the buttons
triangle different. Three times. You good?
Yep. Doing those unlocks one or two, depending on the zone, treasure dig sites, where it's basically Chocobo Hot and Cold from Final Fantasy IX, but made a little bit easier. So you get on your Chocobo, you ride to this site, you have your Chocobo sniff, and it marks a point on the ground. You dig, and that unlocks new ingredients for your crafting, which is fairly inconsequential. You can totally get through the game without ever touching that system if you want, but it's there if you want to get potions for cheap. There's four phenomenon intel. That's part of one mission strand that wraps up in the end game. Now, this one's good because this one's unique for each zone. So in Junin, the four phenomenon missions are Fort Condor battles, which is a tweaked version of the minigame that was in the remake DLC. In the Cosmo Canyon area, it's a completely different minigame. And these are quite in-depth. Like, you know, you think about how Fort Condor is like this quite fully featured strategy game. So you imagine there's, in each zone, there's one of those. Admittedly, in the first zone, it's four battles with a bit of story attached, but the others are all quite unique. And then there's a mini game to unlock your Chocobo, which is usually stealth, where you sneak up on and get on the back and break the Chocobo.
I was absolutely awful at those. Those were controller breaking for me. I have no idea why I was so bad at them, because it's like fucking baby's first stealth game a lot of the time, but I just could not hack it.
I found them okay, but I think they are the sort of thing that's going to frustrate some people, and it's quite a major thing that's locked behind it. And then there's the card game challenges. So each region has a handful, anywhere between like two and seven or eight card game players to beat. It's not like Final Fantasy VIII where you can go up and, or nine, where you can go and challenge anyone. There's set NPCs in each area with set decks, and you beat them all, and it sort of brings that card storyline to a conclusion. And then there's your side quests, which you talked about earlier. So there's up to five in any given area, and each one maps to a particular character in your party. And so that's the open world stuff. And so in my opinion, that ranges from the combat stuff's good because the combat's really good. So just more of that specific challenges. Love that. The phenomenal intel stuff is a bit frustrating. Some of those harder challenges, I feel like they're pushing their luck a bit, but it's good content. But the life springs and the summon crystals, like,
it's very fluffy. It's very like, I mean, here's the thing. Whenever I came across that stuff, I just did it because it takes so little time that it's like inconsequential. But if you were to go at the end, as I now plan to do, because I'd like to plan them on this one too, to match my other ones and do everything, like, it is just mindless repetition. And yeah, I suppose there is enough consequential side missions per area where you could do it. Like, you play a bit of Queen's Blood, you do like a good side mission, or you grab a life spring, you do that kind of thing. That's like ideally the loop. But if you were just to do the kind of the fluffy stuff over and over again, it would get maddening. Ed, did you engage with a lot of that stuff, like per region, or were you more mainlining? What was your kind of experience with that stuff?
I think I did a vast majority of it in the first few regions. Like, I developed like a fascination with doing everything to hear more dialogue and doing all the side quests. But I think the further I got in the story, the more I realized that aside from like the regional phenomena, they were all the open world stuff that's the life springs are going to unlock, like a transmuter ship to dig up or a boss battle and so on. So I'm like you, where I want to go back and do that stuff because I want the platinum, and exploring this world is fun, but it is very like 2013 Ubisoft kind of deal. But I don't think it's as excessive as that, because when you ding a tower, you're never going to reveal like more than four things at once, which is quite digestible. It's like, oh, it would take me 20 minutes to clear all of these. Might as well. So, and then the side quests that accompany that in each region are normally worth doing. I don't think it outstays its welcome at all, which is the biggest fear I had. I thought they were going to go down the direction of this just being filled with bloaty filler, and there is bloaty filler in this game, don't get me wrong, but with a lot of the side stuff I was like, okay, I can take or leave this and it's fun, and the main narrative stuff is otherwise quite excellent and the combat's excellent, so it became much easier to deal with.
I tend to agree. I always wonder if this is a symptom of the way we have to play these games for work, like they become so all-consuming and stuff like that, especially in this situation where some of us had more time than others to play through this like ridiculously long thing. Ed, beyond when you, like me, had to race to the end, were you doing a lot of this side stuff like as it came up, or were you more focused on other things?
Yeah, so the first area, the grasslands, I did absolutely everything, partly just because I wanted to see what was available, but I was sort of intrigued by it, and I am definitely a sort of completionist by nature. So when I get to a new area and I see all the icons, I'm like, I have to do them. And some of them, as we said, are kind of a bit fluffy, but I didn't mind doing that. I felt that the rewards ultimately were kind of worth it. I enjoyed finding out more about the world. I enjoyed having an easier time with the summons. I sort of enjoyed having new items to create. So I feel like all of these, there are lots of these different systems and ideas, but they do ultimately kind of link together. So I didn't mind that. As time went on, I did less and less of it. And as you said, I think that for me was just a symptom of this being a review and we have to get through it. And ultimately seeing the story was more important to me than seeing a summon or, you know, whatever else was there. As Alex said, I sort of appreciated that there were different things in each region. The sort of that specific proto relic side quest. I like that they change things up. They mix things up. They have so many ideas. It feels a bit overly stuffed. And I think that for me, it took away from the urgency of the main story a little bit. I think there are some pacing issues in that they've given this huge world to explore. And that's really exciting for fans who are like, great, I get to, you know, not just see a flat green texture, but I can see this entire world and explore it. And that's really exciting for fans. But I feel like the story doesn't progress enough that more of my time is spent doing side content than the main story. And I'm just not convinced that the balance was quite right.
There's a specifically hilarious bit where you go back to a region you were previously in via a new method of transport, let's say, that was altered from how it was originally introduced in the game, and that method of transport is how you get to the end game bit, but like just before that you land back in this area and it's like, you want to go on this like multi-part like whimsical adventure that we're just going to introduce here, we're good. This is this game in like microcosm. It's like these episodes of an anime where they're going on holiday and they're going to the beach and they're like, it's those interstitial episodes, and then in the back of the mind, Cloud every so often is going, you know, Sephiroth's gonna like end the world. Can we like go on with this? Can we go and go on with this the now? Like
the Black Materia, mate, like, we need to get on it.
10 more rounds of Queen's Blood, which I did love, to be fair.
And that section you're talking about is sort of it's guilty of that thing I was saying earlier as well, of bringing back people for the sake of seeing them again. I mean, I 100%ed everything as I went, which was fine for the first three areas. It got pretty brutal for Area 4 and 5, I felt. I think it's, like I say, I don't mind the towers. They're painless enough. The combat assignments, the combat is the best thing about this game. A lot of this stuff unlocks new stuff in the combat simulator as well, which I think is excellent. Like, if you're, I'm an RPG systems nerd, so if you want to get into that nuts and bolts, I'm really looking forward to playing hard mode, because I really feel like that was where Final Fantasy VII Remake lived, was in hard mode.
Yeah,
you unlock hard at the end.
Okay. Yeah, it's the same. It is the same structure as Remake, so hard mode has more or less the same parameters as Remake, if anyone's curious. But yeah, I did burn out. But I think actually most of my burnout, because like you say, a lot of those summon crystals, it takes a minute. You know what I mean? It's frustrating that it's the same every time. Same for the live springs. But actually where I got frustrated was not the content. It was Gungaga in particular, I think is, I am not joking when I say this. I think it's one of the single worst navigation wise open world areas in any AAA world game I've ever played.
It's jarring because you go from the vastness of coral to this like dense, almost maze-like jungle. It's whiplash when you go there.
And it's the fact that, so every area has a mechanic, and in Gungaga, it's bouncing off mushrooms to reach higher places and stuff like that. But weirdly, the mushrooms aren't marked on the map, whereas the glide points in Cosmo Canyon and the zip lines in Coral are. So there's that weird thing of they marked those, the traversal thing, on two others, but not on Gungaga. And it's not clear where each mushroom leads until you get on it. And then the mushrooms send you quite fast. Then if you want to go back on yourself, you've got to loop back around. And sometimes you can get lost when you're looping back around. And that was where I got frustrated. I actually took a day off the game because I was just really annoyed. Because there were icons on my map that I wanted to clear before I moved on, which, to be fair, is on me. Absolutely on me. But I couldn't figure out how to get to them because it's all verticality and it's all based on the mushrooms. And it's like, okay, I'm standing on top of this icon, but it's clearly actually above or below me. And there's no clear. And it's like, you know, the stupid bloody yellow paint effect.
Yeah.
This is a game.
Oh, that's not everywhere. Get into that.
But this is my point. This is a game that has the yellow paint because it thinks people can't be trusted to find the ledges going up, which I think I do think the yellow paint's a good idea because not everyone has played a million video games. This is a game that has the yellow paint, but then it has this where you can literally spend 45 minutes, like, completely lost, trying to find one thing. Even when it asks you to, go from the village of Gungaga at one point to the reactor.
That's a slog.
There's a set route you're supposed to take, and that route is really quick, but I did not find that route the first time. And so, ironically, it's sort of playing that pumped-up, hurry-up music, which actually on the original soundtrack of the original Final Fantasy VII is called Hurry. And you can't hurry because you're bouncing off mushrooms. You're like, how the hell do I get to where I'm supposed to be going? And so that burned me out a little bit. I do think I plan to say, I haven't written my review yet, but I plan to say in my review, I think you could probably lop 25% of the stuff out, the open world stuff. And I think you would actually have a better, slightly more balanced game for it. And I think it would eliminate some of the pacing stuff that you talked about, Ed, where you just started not doing everything. Imagine being me. And I remember I wrote in my notes that when I got to the gold source, I'm looking at my notes now. That the PS5 OS estimate was that I was 50% in exactly when I arrived at the gold saucer. And that for me was 26 hours in. And keep in mind, I'd 100%ed every region up to that point. And by the time I was like 66% in, it was all my game clock was over 50 hours, which I think speaks to the imbalance in the story to the side stuff. And I think they could have locked some of it out, but I don't think any of it's offensive, and it's certainly not Ubisoft icon.
No, definitely not.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, it's weird because when my partner was watching it, she was like, I would love to play a version of this where none of that open world, you could just turn off all that open world stuff and you could just go from like the really high quality, full of CGI, mission to mission to mission to mission kind of stuff. And I think, like, I get where they're coming from, especially because visually, this game is like it's total peaks and valleys, because occasionally I'll look at it and look at a texture or look at a weird face and stuff like that, and I'll be like, this doesn't look great. And then some of the big expensive CG stuff is like, oh my god, this is absolutely incredible, like the visuals are ridiculous. So it's kind of all over the place with that. But yeah, from a narrative perspective, if someone was to say to me, what is the story of Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, I feel like I would talk about the start, and then the rest of the time I would be talking about the last 2 hours of the game, because
it's a road trip, baby.
The bits in the middle are just, do you want to hang about with Aerith and Tifa and bloody Kate Sith and his Scottish accent, which it's a real Scottish person, so points on the board there. Yes, I feel like we're not down on it, but we keep seeing it as an excellent game. Alex, give it.
We can't give talk some about compliments the good story. Shit.
This is one of those. This is one of those games though where I think, I don't know. See how you guys get on, but I feel when I write my review, it will be an extremely difficult review to get balanced, because I am overwhelmingly positive on this game, but the stuff that I'm really positive on is just sort of can be summed up in, yeah, the combat slaps. The soundtrack is one of the best soundtracks ever in video games.
Oh, there's that.
The character models are, in my opinion, some of the best in the industry. Yes, they're not as intricate as, say, Last of Us character models, but they are so expressive and so beautiful and such a wonderful utilization of Tetsuya Nomura and Roberto Ferrari's art styles. And all that stuff is, you can say that in about 5 minutes. But all the stuff that there is to complain about the game, all the stuff that you actually really have to get into the nitty-gritty of why that stuff is good, not great, or why that stuff is fundamentally flawed. And that takes time. I feel like that only ever happens with good games. Like with bad games, it's quite easy to go, well, you know, the combat's shit, whatever. But here it's like, the combat's really good. However, when you compare it to Remake, something that I'm quite curious about, and I'm quite curious to see like the hardcore RPG fans engage with a little bit, is they've added so many systems in terms of the weapon upgrades and in terms of the, I can't even remember what that skill tree is called, but it looks like another Final Fantasy.
The folio.
It looks like Crystarium and Spear Grid and all that stuff. It looks like that. They've added so much and all that, that I feel like they've massively degraded the utility and importance of materia, which was sort of the central conceit of Final Fantasy VII's combat in all the games, even Crisis Core and before Crisis, up until this point. Because they even give you magic spells that you can use that don't cost MP and don't require materia. And yes, they're extremely weak, but when you've got an enemy where they get pressured when you use a fire attack, it now no longer matters if you've got a fire materia equipped or not, because you can still do that, which on one hand it's like, oh, is that good because it's a bit more frictionless and you're not going to die in a battle and go, oh, I've got to go away and equip fire materia? Or is it actually becoming a bit reductive where that was potentially a good thing because it made you engage with the RPG systems and it made you change your materia loadouts often? I did not really, unless I got something new that was exciting, I wasn't really changing my materia loadouts in this game.
I don't think I ever changed mine.
It was the stuff I used the least, especially with the synergy stuff.
Yeah, the main thing that I...
And that doesn't kill the combat.
Was there was a specific fight that I came in kind of underleveled for, but I realised it was weak to thunder, and I gave Aerith the bit of materia that automatically raises the linked materia one level, so she had the top level thunder spell.
Yes.
And then it just completely broke the fight, because I was just putting her in a ward, sending that thunder spell, and the line was going, woo! So it's... Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't kill the combat, like I say. I think the combat's still really good, but I think it's... In fact, the combat's still excellent. Probably the best combat in the entire Final Fantasy series. But that stuff is interesting. And that stuff's the stuff where I'm like, I'm not 100% on if this is a massive step above Remake. But because it's sort of better in some ways. In some ways, I think it's a bit more compromised. But it is really, 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 really good. But I don't know, maybe you guys feel slightly differently, but I feel like it's just an easy game to talk about what wasn't right. Because the stuff that's right is so right, it barely warrants discussion.
Yeah, because, yeah, that's totally it. And then you get into the point where you're talking to someone about it and they're like, oh, so you didn't like it then? I was like, no, because, like, the highs are so, like, magnificently high here. Like, the combat's incredible. The production values are, I don't know, second to none in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And, like, the open world stuff is relatively good. So when you get onto the bugbears, they can feel overbearing, but
yeah, there's, like, a specific bit that I'll have to speak obliquely about at the end of the game that really was, like, it kind of decided my review for me. Like, they tease a certain piece of music throughout the entire game and they don't go ham on it. And you wait and you wait and you wait and they do, like, the most perfect fucking needle drop moment for this piece of music to start. And I, like, felt myself, like, sitting up in my chair, like, getting fucking into it. And I was like, okay, this is the stuff why, for me, as I've already written my review, is, like, it's a 5-star review for me, where throughout the review I'm like, that's a bit fluffy here, and that's, and then there's a little line that's like, the characters are fucking brilliant, I want to hang about with Aerith and Tifa for the rest of my life. Like, I would happily do another full game of this road trip stuff just for those bits. So yeah, it's I'm cautious of the fact that when we complain about this stuff, there will be plenty of people that are just like, cool, that's fine, like, expected kind of stuff. But these are the... It's kind of the difficulty with reviewing a game that you feel so strongly about positively. You have to say this kind of stuff. Ed, where do you think you're going to come down on it? You don't need to spoil your score or whatever if you've not decided yet, but where are you feeling on it?
I haven't decided, and I'm still a bit up in the air. I mean, I think just to go back a step, like, in terms of, like, what is positive, I think the negative side of things is some of the mechanical things that are quite easy to talk about. I think the good things about the game are tone and feeling. And for me, one of the things I love about this game is how funny it is. I was laughing throughout. There were so many good gags. I think that they've got these iconic characters from this classic game that people love, people know and love and have loved for years. And they're not afraid to make them look really stupid for the sakes of a laugh and completely undermine them. And I love that, you know, they're not too precious about it. I think there is so much humor in this game, that I absolutely loved. I think they really nailed it. For me, it's, I see the overarching story of Seven as quite emo and depressing, as, like, the end of the world is coming and it's all muted colors and dour and everyone's sad about the end of the world. And then I'm just going to go off and play cards and ride a giant chicken and speak to a talking animal. Like, it's all over the place, and I love that they have really leaned into both of those things. I think there are some really emotional moments that are really sad, which are done incredibly well. I think there are some really funny moments. I think there's a lot of joy in the game. There's a lot of joy in this world that I wasn't anticipating. I've spent far too long playing Queen's Blood
is so fucking good.
It's great. So I think that could be a standalone game. I don't know why they don't do
it. It's like Gwent.
I don't know why they don't do a standalone package that is literally, do a package that is a downloadable game, $40, and it's Triple Triad, Tetramaster, and Queen's Blood with online play.
Like the Pokemon trading card.
You can have that idea if you're listening.
I'd buy that. I'd absolutely buy that. I really wanted to get into Chocobo Racing and then saw how vast it was and was like, I just don't have the time
right
now.
It's like a Mario Kart clone, like the whole
literally
thing.
It's the,
like,
Chocobo really GP inside of Rebirth. It's
you know, better than Chocobo GP. That's the mad thing.
Yeah. I think, you know, the team have been so generous with what they've offered here, in that they are really trying to give fans everything. And I think that is for better and worse. So
yeah,
I think it's kind of just, I'm still a bit up in the air about where I'm going to land, because I've still got the last section of the game in my mind. which is sort of what's making me reconsider things a little.
I think what you just said, for better and worse, is like it's like the tagline for a review of this game in a way.
Well, you can have that, Alex. You're welcome.
Because it is very much, I genuinely might, but like it's because it is sort of like what you said about they're so determined to give fans what they want. The feeling I get about, and again, we're not doing spoilers and we're not allowed to do spoilers anyway, but just to talk broadly about the story in the broadest of strokes, I think that they sort of want to do all things to please all people. And in a game design sense, in a mechanical sense, you can take a kitchen sink approach. And in an approach to character development and stuff like that, you can find time for all these moments. It's like they give Aerith and Tifa so many great moments together because they know fans want that. And they're going to launch 1,000 cosplays and fan arts with like them two dressed up in disguise for the Dune and stuff and all that sort of stuff. But the flip side of that is when it comes to the big component parts of the story, can you satisfy everyone, or do you end up in a situation where you please no one? You know what I mean? Mm. And so I think they sort of run aground on that, but you are so right about the tone and the mood. And sometimes they just make decisions that you just don't think about. Like, you know, I've been a fan of this game for years, the original game, and sort of, you know, have a sad encyclopedic knowledge of the characters of this game and stuff like that. And yet I'd never really considered the narrative utility about Barrett and Yuffie and where they are and who they are as people. And the game slowly pairs those guys together quite often. And they sort of have this weird ribbing sort of little
relationship. Very like sibling dynamic almost.
Where they, you know, or an annoyed stepdad sort of thing. Yeah. But then you realize that actually they're two sides of the same coin, where Barrett is gruff and rough because he's hurt, but there's sort of a teddy bear underneath. And Yuffie is sort of bubbly and lovely and excitable, but actually she's ripped to pieces underneath. And actually their pain has the same source right down to an individual person. And it's the moment that clicked for me, I was just like, these characters are so, so fabulous. Or, you know, they pair Barrett and Red, and they make sort of a point of Red's story is about fathers and sons, and Barrett's story is about fathers and daughters, and they're so, so deft with it. And when you talk, see, when you get into that stuff, I gush. I'm not going,
yeah,
it's great,
that's, that's the stuff that's hard to, you can't put that in 1,000 words. That's like multi-hour fucking video essays. So yes, I think, how long till the next one? Is it this console generation? What are we thinking? Because,
well, I mean, you would think they've built a lot of it, right? Like I was thinking about this, and we getting into the weeds on it now. But like, if you think about the world of Final Fantasy VII, and you think about the structure of this game now, what open zones do you have left? You have Midil in the area around Midil. You've got Rocket Town in the area around Rocket Town.
Like Northern Crater.
You've got Wutai. And you've got, well, I would say the Northern Crater would probably be a dungeon, but you've got Icicle in and the area around there, which actually leads up towards the Northern Crater. So if you're doing that, that's four new open zones. So presumably for the next game, you do four new open zones and you do the existing six plus Midgar in a meteor above, you know, configuration and a bunch of new events, and that's your game, right? So you would think that they could turn this one around a wee bit quicker. And certainly even this was quick. You look at the size of the game and the fact that this has been 4 years. Kind of bonkers. So I think they could probably do it for 2027.
Yeah,
I think.
I would love for it to be sooner. Like say, I think Remake set up a lot of the combat and the characterization and the visual style, all that sort of stuff. This one has set up the open world. So the third game is kind of just a victory lap of, and that's kind of what the third act of the original game is anyway. It's sort of just, oh, I'll just do a victory lap and go back to all the places and get all the things.
I feel like that's the thing though, right? Like actually, when you think about the first game, the original game, I think you can't necessarily remake what remains of the story in as point to point to point away as they did here, I think they're going to have to come up with quite a lot of new events.
Yeah.
Because the last third of the first game is sort of just... It's you can tell that they were rushing to finish that game, basically. It's one of the best games of all time, but you can still tell that. Like, it doesn't even have the PS1... The other PS1 FFs have truly epic final dungeons. Final Fantasy VIII got the best final dungeon in RPG history, I would say. 7 doesn't really have that. It is sort of, go to Fort Condor, have a fight, get a big materia. Go here, have a fight, get a big materia. Go here, have a fight, get a big materia. Stand on a shore and have a weapon fight.
Yeah.
You know, it's very, very quick.
Especially when they take later events from that final act and incorporate them into this.
Exactly. Game. Which I guess is why they've pushed Wutai off to that as well, because they're setting up all this Wutai War stuff a lot in this game. They're talking about it a lot. And you would think Wutai maybe even makes up 20 hours of the next game, probably.
Yeah, they're going to make that much bigger.
Wutai clan ain't nothing to fuck with, as they say. There's an excellent reference to one of the minigames that is likely going to be in 3 and the Golden Saucer, if you go and look for it. There's a little conversation that made me chuckle my head off about I suppose I can't remember if I made up them saying that this wasn't going to be in this game, but I'm gonna wave here, so if I need to cut this out, I do. Is it known that there's no snowboarding in this? Has that been previously said?
Well, no, because they said anyone who knows the story will know that, because they have been absolutely clear in all the marketing that, just like they were in the first game, which was like the game leads up to the escape from Midgar. And they've said very clearly, it's on the bottom of every single press release, the game concludes at the Forgotten Capital. And the snowboarding is the thing, is basically the next thing that happens. Which is weird, because that means that's going to happen extremely early.
They're going to be shredding while you're grieving.
But it is cute that they have it, because obviously the snowboarding is a mini game that you do and you can play in the Gold Saucer. But it only unlocks in the Gold Saucer after you do it for real. And it's quite cute, yes, that they have the snowboarding in the correct place, complete with what could very well be a screenshot of of work in progress, because there is literally a screenshot of Kate Sif's Moogle doing snowboarding, and it's like under construction. Yes, like, yes, yeah, we'll be back next game.
There's still a lot of people standing there.
It's a bit like, there's no chocobo breeding either, right? That's another big one.
Yes, you've just got the racing instead.
There's two people standing outside that being like, do you hear what they're going to put in there next? It's going to be snow. Oh, I'll let you hear that next time. It's like, oh, there's a fucking confidence to these games, man. They know what they're doing. Like, so how long is this third game going to be? 200 hours to complete? Something like that? If we're just exponentially expanding how long these games are going to be?
I think the next one will be shorter. I don't know.
Well, I think... We'll see. I don't know. Like, you know, there's 4 critics talking here, but I feel like the feedback will probably come in that it's a bit much this time, and they will react accordingly, and maybe they will lop out that 20 to 25% that I was complaining about. but I can see it being a wee bit shorter. But, you know, I think I'm excited for the next game, because sort of, like I say, they have literally, I would say, done every single major beat that people really talk about and remember from the first game is done now. I guess there's the actual Highwind itself, and there's the submarine, but I don't feel like
you're getting down the tier list of what people think about Final Fantasy VII. As soon as it was finished, even though I think this one's a bit overlong, as soon as it was finished, I was like, I would play the third one right now with like these exact same mechanics. Like, it doesn't need to look any better. Like, we're kind of ready to go there. But yes, you can check out all of our reviews across the various websites.
I'm doing VG247. I expect Josh, who's reviewing it on RPG, his save file was 130 hours. That guy did it real and did it raw. So I expect his review will be very good too. But yeah, I'll be on VG247, and I've written, I don't know, half of it so far. This is one of those reviews that's a hard slog, like I said, because it's about that balance thing, because you want to tell people this is a good video game and this is worth your time, while also making clear that there's a lot of it that's well flawed. In that sense, it is very similar to 16, actually.
Yeah.
I just think it's way more confident and way more accomplished at the things it's trying to do well.
I tend to agree. Jade, over on The Gamer, you written up yet? You finalized those views?
So I'm in the final stretch now. Like, I think, like Alex said, I've got like 4 hours left, maybe getting through those last two chapters. So I'm formulating my thoughts, and I'm going to settle on a score probably tomorrow.
I can't wait until you play those.
Largely very positive.
I can't wait until you play those last 4 hours and then message me being like, can I record an addendum to your podcast? What it is. I absolutely.
Well, I think a spoiler cast is a whole other thing, because there is so much to discuss. And as a lore goblin, from little things that they change that have quite big implications for the next game, to big stuff that happens that sort of, you know,
there's so many unknowns, but also so many exciting things to look forward to in that third game that we've had to talk around constantly in this podcast.
Well, a good example, right, in this game, I know you're trying to wrap up, Jordan.
No, it's fine. Go as long as you want. Obviously,
the end of the last game, we have the whispers and all that sort of stuff. And something I hadn't really thought about until we got there in this game is, in the original Final Fantasy VII, Bugenhagen is an absolutely undisputed font of knowledge. And you listen to everything he says, and he's a really key lore filler in a dropper. And I actually realized within the first scene of meeting him, I was like, oh yeah, we actually know more than him now.
He's a bit
like,
of a boomer.
We, the players and the party, like, his role is pretty irrelevant. He's just an old git who doesn't actually understand. And there's a whole thing, actually, right, where they actually even try to sort of talk about that stuff a little bit, and he's just like, you're just talking nonsense.
Yeah. He's like, oh, you just don't understand the ways. And it's like, well, dude.
And that was from the first game, but I feel like this game introduces a lot more little things like that, that in game three are really going to wrap around the existing narrative.
It's not a spoiler, but there's a specific bit in that section where, like, Aerith's pouring her heart out, and you have, like, a dialogue option, and I fucking pressed the wrong one, and Cloud is just a complete dick to her in the middle of this speech.
Oh, no, giant idiot. I was like, smile.
small little video game nitpick, by the way, just in general, not just about this game, but if you're going to have a timer on dialogue options, right, you're going to have a timer that counts down. If you don't actively select something from that dialogue option, it should be that means you say nothing.
Yeah, I agree.
It shouldn't be it times out and it selects whichever one you're currently highlighting. That's BS. Either Alpha Protocol it or don't do it.
Yeah. Ed, your review up on Eurogamer. You written it yet? You feeling ready to go? Are you going to play more before you get back to writing it, or what's the plan?
I have written a lot of notes. I have a vague structure. It will be written very soon. And at the end of that, I will decide where I feel in terms of numbers.
Is Eurogamer sort of like a 2 out of 5, 3 out of 5, something like that?
I couldn't possibly say.
You didn't give me the score, Grinning. I feel like mine is obvious, though, to be fair.
Oh, yeah, it's Final Fantasy, so it's a guaranteed 5 from you. Anyway, we are going to head off, and I need to go and record my voiceover for this and track down the actor that played Kate Sith and ask if he wants to be on the podcast. Until the next one, you can check us all out on BG247 and RPG site for Alex, Eurogamer for Ed, and The Gamer for Jade. Thank you for joining us on another review cast for VGC, the video game podcast. Your usual episode will be out on Thursday, but until then, say goodbye, Alex.
Bye-bye.
Say goodbye, Jade.
Bye, everyone. Enjoy Final Fantasy. Or not, we'll see.
We'll see. Say goodbye, Ed.
Bye, Ed.
And we'll see you next time.
VGC, a video games podcast, is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.